1940, September 17th. The House of Commons, London. Secret session.
A few days ago, I had a notification from the chiefs of the staff. They considered that the date and time of this meeting of ours today had been so widely advertised that to hold it would be to incur an undue risk, and that it should be put off to some date and hour which had not been publicly announced. I felt, however, that members would be offended if any course was taken which suggested for a moment that we should shirk our duty out of considerations of personal safety. And then there is all that argument which occurs to everyone about setting an example and of the incongruity of our ordering government departments and urging factory workers to remain at work while we ourselves did not assemble on particular occasions as we had resolved to do. Nevertheless, this is a matter on which there should be clear thinking. We should fail in our duty if we went to the other extreme, and in a spirit of mettlesome bravado, made it unduly easy for the enemy to inflict loss and inconvenience upon the public service. We ought not to flatter ourselves by imagining that we are irreplaceable, but at the same time it cannot be denied that 200 or 300 by-elections would be a quite needless complication of our affairs at this particular juncture. Moreover, I suppose that if Hitler made a clean sweep of the Houses of Parliament, it would give widespread and unwholesome satisfaction throughout Germany and be vaunted as another triumph for the Nazi system of government. We must exercise reasonable prudence and a certain amount of guile in combating the malice of the enemy. It is no part of good sense to proclaim the hour and the dates of our meetings long beforehand. Here we are sitting on the target. This group of well-known, prominent buildings and towers between three major railway stations, with the river as a perfect guide by night and day, is the easiest of all targets, and I have very little doubt that they will need extensive repairs before very long. We have seen how unscrupulous and spiteful the enemy is by his daylight attacks on Buckingham Palace, and anyone has only to walk to Smith Square or St. Thomas's Hospital to see the kind of damage that a single aeroplane can do. We have not got to think only of ourselves in considering the matter. There is a large number of officials and staff attached to the House who have to be in attendance upon us when we are sitting. There is no guarantee that the warning will be given in time. Even our watcher up aloft would very likely give his signal only at the moment when the bombs were already released. The firing of the artillery is no useful warning because it fires so often, and we should be hindered in our business if we attended to that. Therefore, I am going to propose to the House three measures which they will find fully consonant with their dignity and with their duty. And with your permission, Mr. Speaker, I now propose to outline their character. The first is that the hours and dates of our sitting shall not be made public in the press or announced beforehand, and that they shall be left in uncertainty. Therefore, I propose to move that when we adjourn today, it will be to an hour and a date which will, as far as possible, be kept secret. But the second measure which I propose is that we should alter the hour of our sitting. We must expect that at any time after dark, the nightly air raiding will begin. Our barrage will be firing, and apart from bombs, great numbers of shell splinters, usually described most erroneously as shrapnel, will be falling in the streets. It is better for members and the officials and staff of the House to be in their homes or in their shelters before this begins. I shall therefore propose that we meet at 11 in the morning and conclude our business at 4 in the afternoon, with half an hour for the debate on the adjournment. This brings me to my third proposal. The fact that we meet in the mornings will be a great convenience to members, but it only throws a heavier burden on ministers and the public departments. Not only cabinets, but many scores of important meetings take place every morning, and the whole work of the staffs and the departments in the afternoon is affected by their decisions. If any large number of ministers have to be in attendance upon the House, the whole progress of war administration will be delayed or even deranged. Take the case of the Minister of Health, who is tomorrow to be in charge of a debate upon the general health of the nation. This is a most interesting and important topic, but the Minister of Health is already working to the utmost limit of his strength on the many difficult situations created by the bombing of London, by its effects on drainage, which is a serious problem, some of our great sewers having been broken, upon the rehousing of persons rendered homeless through their dwellings being destroyed or damaged, or because they have to be evacuated from districts on account of unexploded bombs or other special causes. He has also to deal with the dangers to national health arising out of people being crowded together in shelters and contracting diseases, which under these conditions, unless they are vigorously coped with, may foster epidemics of diphtheria, typhoid, and influenza. In fact, he is fighting the danger of pestilence. Now, I am first of all a parliamentarian and House of Commons man. If I have any say in matters at the present time, it is due mainly to this House, and I therefore set parliamentary duties above everything, subject, of course, to the leave of the House, which I am sure would be generously given. My right honourable friend will therefore carry out the programme as it has been arranged, if the House so desires. But I must appeal to the House to show its consideration for ministers and for a government in whom it has recorded its confidence almost unanimously. We are really doing our very best. There are no doubt many mistakes and shortcomings. A lot of things are done none too well. Some things that ought to be done have not yet been done. Some things have been done that had better have been left undone. But looking broadly at the whole picture, as it is viewed by any impartial eye, the way in which our system of government and society is standing up to its present ordeals, which will certainly increase in severity, constitutes a magnificent achievement and has justly commanded the wonder and admiration of every friendly nation in the world. I ask therefore for the indulgence of the House and for its support in not requiring too many sittings in the next month or two. Of course, if anything happens which raises any novel or fundamental issue for which the authority of Parliament is required, we shall immediately summon Parliament, even if it were only a few days after we have separated, and we shall make it our business to keep in touch with all parties and groups, not only through what are called the usual channels, but through any other channels which may be open. These next few weeks are grave and anxious. I said just now in the public session that the deployment of the enemy's invasion preparations and the assembly of his ships and barges is steadily proceeding, and that at any moment a major assault may be launched upon this island. I now say in secret that upwards of 1,700 self-propelled barges and more than 200 sea-going ships, some very large ships, are already gathered at the many invasion ports in German occupation. If this is all a pretense and stratagem to pin us down here, it has been executed with surprising thoroughness and on a gigantic scale. Some of these ships and barges, when struck by our bombing counterattack and preventive attack, have blown up with tremendous explosions, showing that they are fully loaded with all the munitions needed for the invading armies and to beat us down and subjugate us utterly. The shipping available and now assembled is sufficient to carry in one voyage nearly 500,000 men. We should, of course, expect to drown a great many on the way over and to destroy a large proportion of their vessels. But when you reflect upon the many points from which they could start, and upon the fact that even the most likely sector of invasion, that is to say, the sector in which enemy fighter support is available for their bombers and dive bombers, extending from the Wash to the Isle of Wight, is nearly as long as the whole front in France, from the Alps to the sea, and also from the danger of fog or artificial fog, one must expect many lodgements or attempted lodgements to be made on our island simultaneously. The difficulties of the invader are not ended when he sets foot on shore. A new chapter of perils opens upon him. I am confident we shall succeed in defeating and largely destroying this most tremendous onslaught by which we are now threatened. And anyhow, whatever happens, we will all go down fighting to the end. I feel as sure as the sun will rise tomorrow that we shall be victorious. But I ask the House to assist us in solving these problems, worse than any that have ever threatened the civilized community before, by meeting the wishes of the government in the arrangement of parliamentary business and in lightening the burden which rests upon the men in charge.
Desert Victory, from the Second World War, Chapter 31.
We may, I am sure, rate this tremendous year as the most splendid, as it was the most deadly year in our long English and British story. It was a great, quaintly organized England that had destroyed the Spanish Armada. A strong flame of conviction and resolve carried us through the 25 years conflict which William II and Marlborough waged against Louis XIV. There was a famous period with Chatham. There was the long struggle against Napoleon, in which our survival was secured through the domination of the seas by the British Navy under the classic leadership of Nelson and his associates. 1 million Britons died in the First World War, but nothing surpasses 1940. By the end of that year, this small and ancient island, with its devoted commonwealth, dominions, and attachments under every sky, had proved itself capable of bearing the whole impact and weight of world destiny. All our latent strength was now alive. The air terror had been measured. The island was intangible, inviolate. Henceforward, we too would have weapons with which to fight. Henceforward, we too would be a highly organized war machine. We had shown the world that we could hold our own. There were two sides to the question of Hitler's world domination. Britain, whom so many had counted out, was still in the ring, far stronger than she had ever been, and gathering strength with every day. Time had once again come over to our side, and not only to our national side. The United States was arming fast and drawing ever nearer to the conflict. Soviet Russia, who with callous miscalculation had adjudged us worthless at the outbreak of the war, and had bought from Germany fleeting immunity and a share of the booty, had also become much stronger and had secured advanced positions for our own defense. Japan seemed for the moment to be overawed by the evident prospect of a prolonged world war, and anxiously watching Russia and the United States, meditated profoundly what it would be wise and profitable to do. And now this Britain and its far-spread association of states and dependencies, which had seemed on the verge of ruin, whose very heart was about to be pierced, had been for 15 months concentrated upon the war problem, training its men, and devoting all its infinitely varied vitalities to the struggle. With a gasp of astonishment and relief, the smaller neutrals and the subjugated states saw that the stars still shone in the sky. Hope, and within it passion, burned anew in the hearts of hundreds of millions of men. The good cause would triumph. Right would not be trampled down. The flag of freedom, which in this fateful hour was the Union Jack, would still fly in all the winds that blew. But I and my faithful colleagues, who brooded with accurate information at the summit of the scene, had no lack of cares. The shadow of the U-boat blockade already cast its chill upon us. All our plans depended upon the defeat of this menace. The Battle of France was lost. The Battle of Britain was won. The Battle of the Atlantic had now to be fought.
Give us the tools and we will finish the job. A world broadcast from London, February the 9th, 1941.
A Nazi invasion of Great Britain last autumn would have been a more or less improvised affair. Hitler took it for granted that when France gave in, we should give in.
But we did not give in. And he had to think again. An invasion now will be supported by a much more carefully prepared tackle and equipment of landing craft and other apparatus, all of which will have been planned and manufactured during the winter months. We must all be prepared to meet gas attacks, parachute attacks, and glider attacks with constancy, forethought, and practiced skill. In order to win the war, Hitler must destroy Great Britain. With every month that passes, the many proud and once happy countries he is now holding down by brute force and vile intrigue are learning to hate the Prussian yoke and the Nazi name as nothing has ever been hated so fiercely and so widely among men before. And all the time, masters of the sea and air, the British Empire, nay, in a certain sense, the whole English-speaking world, will be on his track, bearing with them the swords of justice. The other day, President Roosevelt gave his opponent in the late presidential election a letter of introduction to me. And in it he wrote out a verse in his own handwriting from Longfellow, which he said applies to you people as it does to us. Here is the verse. Sail on, O ship of state. Sail on, O Union, strong and great. Humanity, with all its fears, with all the hopes of future years, is hanging breathless on thy fate. What is the answer that I shall give in your name to this great man, the thrice chosen head of a nation of 130 million? Here is the answer which I will give to President Roosevelt. Put your confidence in us. Give us your faith and your blessing. And under Providence, all will be well. We shall not fail or falter. We shall not weaken or tire. Neither the sudden shock of battle nor the long-drawn trials of vigilance and exertion will wear us down. Give us the tools, and we will finish the job.
Westward, look, the land is bright. A world broadcast from London, April the 27th, 1941.
I was asked last week whether I was aware of some uneasiness which it was said existed in the country on account of the gravity, as it was described, of the war situation. So I thought it would be a good thing to go and see for myself what this uneasiness amounted to. And I went to some of our great cities and seaports, which have been most heavily bombed, and to some of the places where the poorest people have got it worst. I have come back not only reassured, but refreshed. It is a tonic which I should recommend any who are suffering from fretfulness to take in strong doses when they have need of it. It is quite true that I've seen many painful scenes of havoc and of fine buildings and acres of cottage homes blasted into rubble heaps of ruin. But it is just in those very places where the malice of the savage enemy has done its worst, and where the ordeal of the men, women, and children has been most severe, that I found their morale most high and splendid. Indeed, I felt encompassed by an exaltation of spirit in the people which seemed to lift mankind and its troubles above the level of material facts into that joyous serenity we think belongs to a better world than this. Of their kindness to me, I cannot speak, because I've never sought it or dreamed of it, and can never deserve it. I can only assure you that I and my colleagues, or comrades rather, for that is what they are, will toil with every scrap of life and strength, according to the lights that are granted to us, not to fail these people, or be wholly unworthy of their faithful and generous regard. The British nation is stirred and moved, and it never has been at any time in its long, eventful, famous history. And it is no hackneyed trope of speech to say that they mean to conquer or to die. You will remember how in November the Italian dictator fell upon the unoffending Greeks and without reason and without warning invaded their country, and how the Greek nation, reviving their classic fame, hurled his armies back at the double quick. Meanwhile, Hitler, who had been creeping and worming his way steadily forward, doping and poisoning and pinioning one after the other, Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria, suddenly made it clear that he would come to the rescue of his fellow criminal. The lack of unity among the Balkan states had enabled him to build up a mighty army in their midst. While nearly all the Greek troops were busy beating the Italians, the tremendous German military machine suddenly towered up on their other frontier. In their mortal peril, the Greeks turned to us for succor. Strained as were our resources, we could not say them nay. By solemn guarantee, given before the war, Great Britain had promised them her help. They declared they would fight for their native soil, even if neither of their neighbors made common cause with them, and even if we left them to their fate. But we could not do that. There are rules against that kind of thing, and to break those rules would be fatal to the honor of the British Empire, without which we could neither hope nor deserve to win this hard war. Military defeat or miscalculation can be redeemed. The fortunes of war are fickle and changing, but an act of shame would deprive us of the respect which we now enjoy throughout the world, and thus would sap the vitals of our strength. We, for our part, were, of course, bound to hearken to the Greek appeal to the utmost limit of our strength. We put the case to the dominions of Australia and New Zealand, and their governments, without in any way ignoring the hazards, told us that they felt the same as we did. So an important part of the mobile portion of the Army of the Nile was sent to Greece in fulfillment of our pledge. It happened that the divisions available and best suited to this task were from New Zealand and Australia, and that only about half the troops who took part in this dangerous expedition came from the mother country. I see the German propaganda is trying to make bad blood between us and Australia by making out that we have used them to do what we would not have asked of the British Army. I shall leave it to Australia to deal with that taunt.
Winston Churchill then spoke as follows.
No prudent and far-seeing man can doubt that the eventual and total defeat of Hitler and Mussolini is certain, in view of the respective declared resolves of the British and American democracies. There are less than 70 million malignant Huns, some of whom are curable and others killable, most of whom are already engaged in holding down Austrians, Czechs, Poles, and the many other ancient races they now bully and pillage. The peoples of the British Empire and of the United States number nearly 200 million in their homeland and in the British dominions alone. They possess the unchallengeable command of the oceans and will soon obtain decisive superiority in the air. They have more wealth, more technical resources, and they make more steel than the whole of the rest of the world put together. They are determined that the cause of freedom shall not be trampled down, nor the tide of world progress turned backwards by the criminal dictators. While, therefore, we naturally view with sorrow and anxiety much that is happening in Europe and in Africa and may happen in Asia, we must not lose our sense of proportion and thus become discouraged or alarmed. When we face with a steady eye the difficulties which lie before us, we may derive new confidence by remembering those we have already overcome. Nothing that is happening now is comparable in gravity with the dangers through which we passed last year. Nothing that can happen in the East is comparable with what is happening in the West. Last time I spoke to you, I quoted the lines of Longfellow which President Roosevelt had written out for me in his own hand. I have some other lines which are well known, but which seem apt and appropriate to our fortunes tonight, and I believe they will be so judged wherever the English language is spoken or the flag of freedom flies. For while the tired waves vainly breaking seem here no painful inch to gain, far back through creeks and inlets making comes silent flooding in the main. And not by eastern windows only, when daylight comes in the light. In front the sun climbs slow, how slowly. But westward, look, the land is bright.
Until victory is won, a speech to a conference of Dominion High Commissioners and Allied Countries Ministers at St. James Palace, London, June the 12th, 1941.
In the 22nd month of the war against Nazism, we meet here in this old palace of St. James's, itself not unscarred by the fire of the enemy, in order to proclaim the high purposes and resolves of the lawful constitutional governments of Europe, whose countries have been overrun. And we meet here also to cheer the hopes of free men and free peoples throughout the world. Here before us on the table lie the title deeds of 10 nations or states whose soil has been invaded and polluted and whose men, women and children lie prostrate or writhing under Hitler's yoke. But here also, duly authorized by the Parliament and Democracy of Britain, are gathered the servants of the ancient British monarchy and the accredited representatives of the British dominions beyond the seas of Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa, of the Empire of India, of Burma, and of all our colonies in every quarter of the globe. They have drawn their swords in this cause. They will never let them fall till life is gone or victory is won. Here we meet, while from across the Atlantic Ocean the hammers and lathes of the United States signal in a rising hum their message of encouragement and their promise of swift and ever-growing aid. What tragedies, what horrors, what crimes,
of Hitler and all that Hitler stands for brought upon Europe and the world. The ruins of Warsaw, of Rotterdam, of Belgrade are monuments which will long recall to future generations the outrage of the unopposed air bombing applied with calculated scientific cruelty to helpless populations. Here in London and through the cities of our land and in Ireland, there may also be seen marks of devastation. They are being repaid, and presently they will be more than repaid. It will not be by German hands that the structure of Europe will be rebuilt or the union of the European family achieved. In every country into which the German armies and the Nazi police have broken, there has sprung up from the soil a hatred of the German name and a contempt for the Nazi creed, which the passage of hundreds of years will not efface from human memory. We cannot see yet how deliverance will come or when it will come. But nothing is more certain than that every trace of Hitler's footsteps, every stain of his infected and corroding fingers will be sponged and purged and, if need be, blasted from the surface of the earth. Hitler may turn and trample this way and that through tortured Europe. He may spread his course far and wide and carry his curse with him. He may break into Africa or into Asia. But it is here, in this island fortress, that he will have to reckon in the end. We shall strive to resist by land and sea. We shall be on his track wherever he goes. Our air power will continue to teach the German homeland that war is not all loot and triumph. We shall aid and stir the people of every conquered country to resistance and revolt. We shall break up and derange every effort which Hitler makes to systematize and consolidate his subjugation. He will find no peace, no rest, no halting place, no parley. And if driven to desperate hazards, he attempts the invasion of the British Isles, as well he may, we shall not flinch from the supreme trial. With the help of God, of which we must all feel daily conscious, we shall continue steadfast in faith and duty till our task is done. This, then, is the message which we send forth today to all the states and nations, bond or free, to all the men in all the land who care for freedom's cause, to our allies and well-wishers in Europe, to our American friends and helpers, drawing ever closer in their might across the ocean. This is the message. Lift up your hearts. All will come right. Out of the depths of sorrow and sacrifice will be born again the glory of mankind.
June the 16th, 1941. A radio speech to America on receiving the honorary degree of Doctor of Laws of the University of Rochester, New York.
For more than a year, we British have stood alone, uplifted by your sympathy and respect, sustained by our own unconquerable willpower, and by the increasing growth and hopes of your massive aid. In these British islands that look so small upon the map, we stand the faithful guardians of the rights and dearest hopes of a dozen states and nations now gripped and tormented in a base and cruel servitude. Whatever happens, we shall endure to the end. But what is the explanation of the enslavement of Europe by the German Nazi regime? How did they do it? It is but a few years ago since one united gesture by the peoples, great and small, who now lie broken in the dust, would have warded off from mankind the fearful ordeal it has had to undergo. But there was no unity. There was no vision. The nations were pulled down one by one, while the others gaped and chattered. One by one, each in his turn, they let themselves be caught. One after another,
they were felled by brutal violence or poisoned from within by subtle intrigue. Now the old lion, with her lion cubs at her side, stands alone against hunters who are armed with deadly weapons and impelled by desperate and destructive rage. Is the tragedy to repeat itself once more? Ah, no. This is not the end of the tale. The stars in their courses proclaim the deliverance of mankind. Not so easily shall the onward progress of the peoples be barred. Not so easily shall the lights of freedom die. But time is short. Every month that passes adds to the length and to the perils of the journey that will have to be made. United we stand, divided we fall. Divided, the dark ages return. United, we can save and guide the world.
The fourth climacteric, a world broadcast on the German invasion of Russia, June the 22nd, 1941.
I have taken occasion to speak to you tonight because we have reached one of the climacterics of the war. In the first of these intense turning points, a year ago, France fell prostrate under the German hammer, and we had to face the storm alone. The second was when the Royal Air Force beat the Hun raiders out of the daylight air and thus warded off the Nazi invasion of our island while we were still ill-armed and ill-prepared. The third turning point was when the President and Congress of the United States passed the Lease and Lend enactment, devoting nearly 2,000 million sterling of the wealth of the New World to help us defend our liberties and their own. Those were the three climacterics. The fourth is now upon us. At 4 o'clock this morning, Hitler attacked and invaded Russia. All his usual formalities of perfidy were observed with scrupulous technique. A non-aggression treaty had been solemnly signed and was in force between the two countries. No complaint had been made by Germany of its non-fulfillment. Under its cloak of false confidence, the German armies drew up in immense strength along a line which stretched from the White Sea to the Black Sea, and their air fleets and armored divisions slowly and methodically took up their stations. Then, suddenly, without declaration of war, without even an ultimatum, the German bombs rained down from the sky upon the Russian cities. The German troops violated the Russian frontiers, and an hour later, the German ambassador, who till the night before was lavishing his assurances of friendship, almost of alliance, upon the Russians, called upon the Russian foreign minister to tell him that a state of war existed between Germany and Russia. Thus was repeated on a far larger scale the same kind of outrage against every form of signed compact and international faith which we have witnessed in Norway, in Denmark, in Holland, in Belgium, and which Hitler's accomplice and jackal Mussolini so faithfully imitated in the case of Greece. All this was no surprise to me. In fact, I gave clear and precise warnings to Stalin of what was coming. I gave him warnings, as I have given warnings to others before. I can only hope that these warnings did not fall unheeded. All we know at present is that the Russian people are defending their native soil, and that their leaders have called upon them to resist to the utmost. Hitler is a monster of wickedness, insatiable in his lust for blood and plunder. Not content with having all Europe under his heel, or else terrorized into various forms of abject submission, he must now carry his work of butchery and desolation among the vast multitudes of Russia and of Asia. The terrible military machine which we and the rest of the civilized world so foolishly, so supinely, so insensately allowed the Nazi gangsters to build up year by year from almost nothing, this machine cannot stand idle, lest it rust or fall to pieces. It must be in continual motion, grinding up human lives and trampling down the homes and the rights of hundreds of millions of men. Moreover, it must be fed, not only with flesh, but with oil. So now this bloodthirsty gutter snipe must launch his mechanized armies upon new fields of slaughter, pillage, and devastation. Poor as are the Russian peasants, workmen, and soldiers, he must steal from them their daily bread. He must devour their harvests. He must rob them of the oil which drives their plows, and thus produce a famine without example in human history. And even the carnage and ruin which is victory, should he gain it, he has not gained it yet, will bring upon the Russian people, will itself be only a stepping stone to the attempt to plunge the 400 or 500 millions who live in China and the 350 million who live in India into that bottomless pit of human degradation over which the diabolic emblem of the swastika flaunts itself. It is not too much to say, here this summer evening, that the lives and happiness of 1,000 million additional human beings are now menaced with brutal Nazi violence. That is enough to make us hold our breath. But presently I shall show you something else that lies behind, and something that touches very nearly the life of Britain and of the United States. The Nazi regime is indistinguishable from the worst features of communism. It is devoid of all theme and principle except appetite and racial domination. It excels all forms of human wickedness in the efficiency of its cruelty and ferocious aggression. No one has been a more consistent opponent of communism than I have for the last 25 years. I will unsay no word that I have spoken about it. But all this fades away before the spectacle which is now unfolding.
Mr. Churchill then went on,
"This is no time to moralize upon the follies of countries and governments which have allowed themselves to be struck down one by one, when by united action they could so easily have saved themselves and saved the world from this catastrophe. But when I spoke a few minutes ago of Hitler's bloodlust and the hateful appetites which have impelled or lured him on his Russian adventure, I said there was one deeper motive behind his outrage. He wishes to destroy the Russian power because he hopes that if he succeeds in this, he will be able to bring back the main strength of his army and air force from the east and hurl it upon this island, which he knows he must conquer or suffer the penalty of his crimes. His invasion of Russia is no more than a prelude to an attempted invasion of the British Isles. He hopes, no doubt, that all this may be accomplished before the winter comes, and that he can overwhelm Great Britain before the fleets and air power of the United States will intervene. He hopes that he may once again repeat upon a greater scale than ever before that process of destroying his enemies one by one by which he has so long thrived and prospered. And that then the scene will be clear for the final act without which all his conquests would be in vain, namely, the subjugation of the Western Hemisphere to his will and to his system. The Russian danger is therefore our danger, and the danger of the United States. Just as the cause of any Russian fighting for his hearth and home is the cause of free men and free peoples in every quarter of the globe. Let us learn the lessons already taught by such cruel experience. Let us redouble our exertions and strike with united strength while life and power remain.
Do your worst, and we will do our best. A speech at a luncheon given by the London County Council after the review of the Civil Defence Services in Hyde Park, July the 14th, 1941.
London is so vast and so strong that she is like a prehistoric monster into whose armored hide showers of arrows can be shot in vain. But a frightful measure of cruelty has been inflicted upon the great cities and seaports of the country. And I say here, when we are entitled to speak of London affairs, particularly, I say here, that we honor them for their constancy in a comradeship of suffering, of endurance, and of triumph. That comradeship under this unprecedented novel pressure, hideous pressure, applied to modern communities, has united us all, and it has proved to the world the quality of our island life. I have no doubt whatever, as I said to the forces, the civil defense forces in Hyde Park this morning, that the behavior of the British people under this trial gained them conquests in the mind, spirit, sympathy of the United States of America, which swept into an ignominious corner all the finest tropes of Goebbels' propaganda. We have to ask ourselves this question. Will the bombing attacks of last autumn and winter come back again?
Mr. Chairman, we are proceeding on the assumption that they will. Some months ago, I requested my right honourable friend, the Home Secretary and Minister of Home Security, and his principal colleagues, the Minister of Health and others, to make every preparation for the autumn and winter war as if we should have to go through the same ordeal as last year, only rather worse. I am assured that everything is being done in accordance with those directions. The shelters are being strengthened, improved, lighted, and warmed. All arrangements for fire control and fire watching are being improved, perpetually. Many new arrangements are being contrived as a result of the hard experience through which we have passed, and the many mistakes, no doubt, we have made. For success is the result of making many mistakes and learning from experience. If many new arrangements have been made, and if the lull is to end, if the storm is to renew itself, London will be ready. London will not flinch. London can take it again. We ask no favors of the enemy. We seek from them no compunction. On the contrary, if tonight the people of London were asked to cast their vote as to whether a convention should be entered into to stop the bombing of all cities, an overwhelming majority would cry, "No, we will mete out to the Germans the measure, and more than the measure, they have meted out to us." The people of London, with one voice, would say to Hitler, "You have committed every crime under the sun. Where you have been the least resisted, there you have been the most brutal. It was you who began the indiscriminate bombing. We remember Warsaw in the very few days, first few days of the war. We remember Rotterdam. We have been newly reminded of your habits by the hideous massacre in Belgrade. We know too well the bestial assault you are making upon the Russian people, to whom our hearts go out in their valiant struggle. We will have no truce or parley with you or the grisly gang who worked your wicked will. You do your worst, and we will do our best." Perhaps it may be our turn soon. Perhaps it may be our turn now. Ladies and gentlemen.
Later in this speech, he said,
"All engaged in our civil defense forces, whether in London or throughout the country, must prepare themselves, ladies and gentlemen, for further heavy assaults. Your organization, your vigilance, your devotion to duty, your zeal for the cause must be raised to the highest intensity. We do not expect a hit without being hit back. And we intend, with every week that passes, to hit harder. Prepare yourselves, then. Prepare yourselves, my friends and comrades, in the Battle of London, for the renewal of your exertions. We shall not turn from our purpose, however somber the road, however grievous the cost, because we know that out of this time of trial and tribulation will be born a new freedom and glory
for all mankind.
London, the House of Commons, July the 29th, 1941, a speech on war production.
I have now described to the committee a number of solid factors which have arisen since the Dunkirk period, all of which have tended to obstruct and reduce output. I should like to give the committee some facts and figures to show how far we have succeeded by improved organization and by the smooth running of our expanding machinery in overcoming these adverse currents which I have set out at length. But here I encounter a new difficulty. I am told we cannot have these debates in secret session. They must be in public. The Germans must read in 2 or 3 days every word we say, and therefore I cannot give actual figures. In addition, I am told by my honorable friends to let us have none of these comparative percentages. Let us not be told that we are producing half as much again, or double what we produced this time last year, because we were producing nothing last year, or something like it. As my honorable friend said, it is a Lancashire saying that twice note is note. So, according to these critics, I am inhibited from all vindicatory comparisons. I must not say how much better we are at this time last year, when, after all, we had been at war for 10 or 11 months, and so were presumably making something. I must not say how much better we are than at the 23rd month of the last war, nor how our output compares with the peak of the last war, because it is contended conditions have changed. This is rather easy money for the critics. A handful of members can fill a couple of days' debate with disparaging charges against our war effort, and every ardent or disaffected section of the press can take it up, and the whole can cry a dismal, cacophonous chorus of stinking fish all round the world. But no answer must be made. Nothing must be said to show the giant war effort, the prodigy of national zeal, which excites the astonishment of friend and foe, which will command the admiration of history, and which have kept us alive. I defy these tyrannical prohibitions. I intend to make comparisons both with the Dunkirk-Dakin period and with the similar and peak periods of the last war. Despite all the troubles I have enumerated, the Ministry of Supply output in the last 3 months has been 1/3 greater than the 3 months of the Dunkirk period. Though our Navy, Army, and Air Force are larger, the Ministry has 1/3 more people working in its factories. Thus, despite dilutions, dispersion, reduced food, the blackout, and all the troubles I have described, each man is turning out on the whole each day as much as he did in that time of almost superhuman effort after Dunkirk. Let me present the balance sheet. 1/3 more workers and 1/3 more output is quit. But all the adverse factors I have described have somehow or other been cancelled out by superior development of our machinery and organization. We have made in the last 3 months more than twice the field guns we made in the Dunkirk period. The ammunition we are turning out is half as much again. The combined merchant and naval shipbuilding now in active progress is bigger, not only in scale, but in current daily volume of execution, than it was at any period in the last war. And of course the work now is immeasurably more complex than it was then. We are told how badly labor is behaving. And then a lot of people who never did a day's hard work in their lives are out after them. Again, I claim, look back to the last war. In that war, we had many bitter and devastating strikes. And in the final 2 years, nearly 12 million working days were lost through labor disputes. So far, in the whole 23 months of this war, we have lost less than 2 million days. I was anxious to have the latest information about trade disputes in the country. I received a few minutes before I rose to speak a report that at 11 o'clock there was no stoppage of work of any kind arising from a trade dispute in any part of Great Britain.
It is a fashion nowadays to abuse the Minister of Labour. He is a workman, a trade union leader. He is taunted with being an unskilled labourer representing an unskilled union. I dare say he gives offence in some quarters. He has his own methods of speech and action. He has a frightful load to carry, yet a job to do which none would envy. He makes mistakes, as I do, though not so many or so serious. He has not the same opportunities. At any rate, he is producing at this moment, though perhaps on rather expensive terms, a vast and steady volume of faithful effort, the like of which has not been seen before. If you tell me that the results he produces do not compare with those of totalitarian systems of government and society, I reply by saying we shall know more about that when we get to the end of the story. I dare say that some of our critics will not like this kind of talk. They call it complacency. Living in comparative idleness, they wish to lash the toilers of body and mind to further exertions. To state facts which are true and encouraging is to be accused of cheap and facile optimism. Our critics do not like it. Neither do the Germans, though for different reasons. But I consider that if for days on end the whole national effort is disparaged and insulted, and if all over the world we are depicted by our friends and countrymen as slack, rotten, and incompetent, we are entitled, nay, it becomes a pressing duty, to restore the balance by presenting the truth. When I look out upon the whole tumultuous scene of this ever-widening war, I feel it my duty to conclude by giving a very serious warning to the House and to the country. We must be on our guard equally against pessimism and against optimism. There are no doubt temptations to optimism. It is the fact that the mighty Russian state, so foully and treacherously assaulted, has struck back with magnificent strength and courage, and is inflicting prodigious and well-deserved slaughter for the first time upon the Nazi armies. It is the fact that the United States, the greatest single power in the world, is giving us aid on a gigantic scale and advancing in rising wrath and conviction to the very verge of war. It is the fact that the German air superiority has been broken and that the air attacks on this country have for the time being almost ceased. It is the fact that the Battle of the Atlantic, although far from won, has, partly through American intervention, moved impressively in our favor. It is the fact that the Nile Valley is now far safer than it was 12 months ago or 3 months ago. It is the fact that the enemy has lost all pretense of theme or doctrine and is sunk ever deeper in moral and intellectual degradation and bankruptcy, and that almost all his conquests have proved burdens and sources of weakness. But all these massive, towering facts which we are entitled to dwell on must not lead us for a moment to suppose that the worst is over. The formidable power of Nazi Germany, the vast mass of destructive munitions they have made or captured, the courage, skill, and audacity of their striking forces, the ruthlessness of their centralized war direction, the prostrate condition of so many great peoples under their yoke, the resources of so many lands which may to some extent become available to them, all these restrain rejoicing and forbid the slightest relaxation. It would be madness for us to suppose that Russia or the United States is going to win this war for us. The invasion season is at hand. All the armed forces have been warned to be at constant pitch by the 1st of September, and to retain the utmost vigilance meanwhile. We have to reckon with a gambler's desperation. We have to reckon with a criminal who, by a mere gesture, has decreed the death of 3 or 4 million Russian and German soldiers. We stand here still the champions. If we fail, all fails. And if we fall, all will fall together. It is only by a superb, intense, and prolonged effort of the whole British Empire that the great combination of about three-quarters of the human race against Nazism will come into vehement and dynamic life. For more than a year, we have been all alone. All alone, we have had to guard the treasure of mankind. Although there have been profound and encouraging changes in the situation, our own vital and commanding responsibilities remain undiminished, and we shall discharge them only by continuing to pour out in the common cause the utmost endeavors of our strength and virtue, and if need be, to proffer the last drop of our heart's blood.
A joint declaration by Mr. Winston Churchill and President Roosevelt at their meeting on board a warship off Newfoundland, August the 14th, 1941. The Atlantic Charter.
The President of the United States and the Prime Minister, Mr. Churchill, representing His Majesty's government in the United Kingdom, being met together, deem it right to make known certain common principles in the national policies of their respective countries, on which they base their hopes for a better future for the world. First, their countries seek no aggrandizement, territorial or other. Second, they desire to see no territorial changes that do not accord with the freely expressed wishes of the peoples concerned. Third, they respect the right of all peoples to choose the form of government under which they will live. And they wish to see sovereign rights and self-government restored to those who have been forcibly deprived of them. Fourth, they will endeavor, with due respect for their existing obligations, to further enjoyment by all states, great or small, victor or vanquished, of access on equal terms to the trade and to the raw materials of the world which are needed for their economic prosperity. Fifth, they desire to bring about the fullest collaboration between all nations in the economic field, with the object of securing for all improved labor standards, economic advancement, and social security. Sixth, after the final destruction of Nazi tyranny, they hope to see established a peace that will afford to all nations the means of dwelling in safety within their own boundaries, and which will afford assurance that all the men in all the lands may live out their lives in freedom from fear and want. Seventh, such a peace should enable all men to traverse the high seas and oceans without hindrances. Eighth, they believe all the nations of the world, for realistic as well as spiritual reasons, must come to the abandonment of the use of force, since no future peace can be maintained if land, sea, or air armaments continue to be employed by nations which threaten, or may threaten, aggression outside their frontiers. They believe, pending the establishment of a wider and permanent system of general security, that the disarmament of such nations is essential. They will likewise aid and encourage all other practicable measures which will lighten for peace-loving peoples the crushing burden of armaments.
The meeting with President Roosevelt. A world broadcast from London, August the 24th, 1941.
I thought you would like me to tell you something about the voyage which I made across the ocean to meet our great friend, the President of the United States. Exactly where we met is a secret. But I don't think I shall be indiscreet if I go so far as to say that it was somewhere in the Atlantic, in a spacious landlocked bay, which reminded me of the west coast of Scotland. Powerful American warships, protected by strong flotillas and far-ranging aircraft, awaited our arrival, and, as it were, stretched out a hand to help us in. Our party arrived in the newest, or almost the newest, British battleship, the Prince of Wales, with a modest escort of British and Canadian destroyers. And there, for 3 days, I spent my time in company, and I think I may say in comradeship, with Mr. Roosevelt, while all the time the chiefs of the staff and naval and military commanders, both of the British Empire and of the United States, sat together in continual council. President Roosevelt is the thrice chosen head of the most powerful state and community in the world. I am the servant of King and Parliament, at present charged with the principal direction of our affairs in these fateful times. And it is my duty also to make sure, as I have made sure, that anything I say or do in the exercise of my office is approved and sustained by the whole British Commonwealth of Nations. Therefore, this meeting was bound to be important because of the enormous forces at present only partially mobilized, but steadily mobilizing, which are at the disposal of these two major groupings of the human family, the British Empire and the United States, who, fortunately, for the progress of mankind, for the progress of mankind, for the same language.
Churchill then went on.
We had the idea, when we met there, the President and I, that without attempting to draw final and formal peace aims, or war aims, it was necessary to give all peoples, and especially the oppressed and conquered peoples, a simple, rough-and-ready wartime statement of the goal towards which the British Commonwealth and the United States mean to make their way, and thus make a way for others to march with them upon a road which will certainly be painful and may be long. There are, however, two distinct and marked differences in this joint declaration from the attitude adopted by the Allies during the latter part of the last war, and no one should overlook them. The United States and Great Britain do not now assume that there will never be any more war again. On the contrary, we intend to take ample precautions to prevent its renewal in any period we can foresee by effectively disarming the guilty nations while remaining suitably protected ourselves. The second difference is this, that instead of trying to ruin German trade by all kinds of additional trade barriers and hindrances, as was the mood of 1917, we have definitely adopted the view that it is not in the interests of the world and of our two countries that any large nation should be unprosperous or shut out from the means of making a decent living for itself and its people by its industry and enterprise. These are far-reaching changes of principle upon which all countries should ponder. Above all, it was necessary to give hope and the assurance of final victory to those many scores of millions of men and women who are battling for life and freedom, or who are already bent down under the Nazi yoke. Hitler and his confederates have for some time past been adjuring, bullying, and beseeching the populations whom they have wronged and injured to bow to their fate, to resign themselves to their servitude, and for the sake of some mitigations and indulgences, to collaborate, that is the word, in what is called the new order in Europe. What is this new order which they seek to fasten first upon Europe, and if possible, for their ambitions are boundless upon all the continents of the globe, It is the rule of the herring folk, the master race, who are to put an end to democracy, to parliament, to the fundamental freedom and decency of ordinary men and women, to the historic rights of nations, and give them in exchange the iron rule of Prussia, the universal goose step, and a strict, efficient discipline enforced upon the working classes by the political police, with the German concentration camps and firing parties, now so busy in a dozen lands, always handy in the background. There is the new order. Napoleon in his glory and his genius spread his empire far and wide. There was a time when only the snows of Russia and the white cliffs of Dover, with their guardian fleets, stood between him and the dominion of the world. Napoleon's armies had a theme. They carried with them the surges of the French Revolution. Liberty, equality, and fraternity, that was the cry. There was a sweeping away of outworn medieval systems and aristocratic privilege. There was the land for the people, a new code of law. Nevertheless, Napoleon's empire vanished like a dream. But Hitler has no theme. Naught but mania, appetite, and exploitation. He has, however, weapons and machinery for grinding down and for holding down conquered countries, which are the product, the sadly perverted product, of modern science. The question has been asked, how near is the United States to war? There is certainly one man who knows the answer to that question. If Hitler has not yet declared war upon the United States, it is surely not out of his love for American institutions. It is certainly not because he could not find a pretext. He has murdered half a dozen countries for far less. Fear of immediately redoubling the tremendous energies now being employed against him is no doubt a restraining influence. But the real reason is, I am sure, to be found in the method to which he has so faithfully adhered and by which he has gained so much. What is that method? It is a very simple method. One by one. That is his plan. That is his guiding rule. That is the trick by which he has enslaved so large a portion of the world. 3.5 years ago, I appealed to my fellow countrymen to take the lead in weaving together a strong defensive union within the principles of the League of Nations, a union of all the countries who felt themselves in ever-growing danger. But none would listen. All stood idle while Germany rearmed. Czechoslovakia was subjugated. A French government deserted their faithful ally and broke a plighted word in that ally's hour of need. Russia was cajoled and deceived into a kind of neutrality or partnership while the French army was being annihilated. The Low Countries and the Scandinavian countries, acting with France and Great Britain in good time, even after the war had begun, might have altered its course and would have had, at any rate, a fighting chance. The Balkan states had only to stand together to save themselves from the ruin by which they are now engulfed. But one by one, they were undermined and overwhelmed. Never was the career of crime made more smooth. Now,
Winston Churchill then spoke as follows.
We had a church parade on the Sunday in our Atlantic Bay. The President came onto the quarterdeck of the Prince of Wales, where there were mingled together many hundreds of American and British sailors and Marines. The sun shone bright and warm, while we all sang the old hymns, which are our common inheritance, and which we learned as children in our home. We sang the hymn founded on the psalm which John Hampden's soldiers sang when they bore his body to the grave, and in which the brief, precarious span of human life is contrasted with the immutability of him to whom 1,000 ages are but as yesterday and as a watch that is passed in the night. We sang the sailor's hymn for those in peril, and there are very many in peril on the sea. We sang Onward, Christian Soldiers. And indeed, I felt that this was no vain presumption, but that we had the right to feel that we were serving a cause for the sake of which a trumpet has sounded from on high. And so we came back across the ocean waves, uplifted in spirit, fortified in resolve. Some American destroyers, which were carrying mails to the United States Marines in Iceland, happened to be going the same way too, so we made a goodly company at sea together. And when we were right out in mid-passage one afternoon, a noble sight broke on the view. We overtook one of the convoys which carry the munitions and supplies of the New World to sustain the champions of freedom in the old. The whole horizon, whole broad horizon, seemed filled with ships. 70 or 80 ships of all kinds and sizes, arrayed in 14 lines, each of which could have been drawn with a ruler. Hardly a wisp of smoke, not a straggler, but all bristling with cannon and other precautions, on which I will not dwell, and all surrounded by their British escorting vessels, while overhead the far-ranging Catalina airboats soared, vigilant, protecting eagles in the sky. And then I felt that hard and terrible and long drawn out as this struggle may be, we shall not be denied the strength to do our duty to the end.